Astrology Podcast. I'm Arwen O'Neill, and I'm here with my good friend Alison Price, and we're coming to you from Vancouver, Canada. Today, we are going to be talking about the astrology of January 26th through February 8th, 2014, and we are going to be talking about our Astrology 360 topic of the day, which is the mind planets, Mercury and Uranus, or Uranus, or Uranus, or anyway, we are going to be discussing that and the moon phases. We have a couple of book reviews, and that's what we're going to be doing.
Some planetary movements?
Indeed. A few.
Not many.
One, really.
Yeah. So maybe we should just have a look at that first and
let's
get it out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. So when we've got on the 30th of January, the first aspect that's going to be occurring is Jupiter opposite Pluto. And the characteristics of that aspect are drive for success, power of persuasion, legal and ego struggles. You're going to be tempted to maybe speak belligerently and powerfully and get your point across by any means necessary.
Maybe go over the top.
Maybe you go over the top, yep. That's that potential is there.
Is this likely for everybody's going to be doing this, do you think?
Well, probably people that have the closer aspects to that actual...
The Cancers and Capricorn.
Maybe. Yeah, Cancers and Capricorns, and near the exactest degrees of the aspect, which is 11 or 12-ish,
I think. Ish, yeah, somewhere around there, probably. Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And also, the 31st, we have a lot of things happening.
We do.
We have Mercury going into Pisces.
Yes.
And we have Venus going direct.
Yes, Venus is going direct. It's been retrograde since last year. We can say that now. In Capricorn, so it's been through Capricorn. It's gone back through Capricorn. It's going to go back now for its third pass through Capricorn.
Yeah.
Crossing over that Pluto.
Yeah, indeed. And Mercury going into Pisces.
Mercury going into Pisces.
Mercury is happy in Pisces. Not as much.
Because it's in its detriment. Yeah. Opposite Virgo.
Yeah, it's a lot happier in Aquarius. But, you know, we've had a good run with that.
We have.
And it will be going retrograde on the 6th of February, so it'll be in Pisces for just about a week before that happens.
Okay.
And then it'll be going back into Aquarius.
Right.
For a little while. So that's good. Mercury in Pisces, some of the key words are poetry, pleasing communications, good listener, moody, dreamy, indirect communication style, soft-spoken.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So those are the planetary ingresses. What is the moon doing?
Yes, the moon. Let's have a look at the moon. Well, the moon's always doing something. Is it? Because it never stays still.
No.
And even as we're watching it, it's moving forward. So what we have is on the 30th, on January the 30th, we've got a new moon in Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a good time. It's the time to start things at the new moon, not before, at the new moon forward. And with the new moon being in Aquarius at 10 degrees Aquarius, wherever that falls in your chart, in which house that falls, the new moon, that's where you want to do your new moon wishing, which means that you can put down beforehand a list of perhaps 10 affirmations on a page about what you'd like to do, whichever house 10 Aquarius occurs in your chart. So you would put down affirmations in line with the house. So, for instance, in your chart, Arwen, that would be in which house?
That would be the third.
The third house.
Exactly. Seems like we've been talking about my third house a lot.
Yes.
It's been active.
So, because the new moon is occurring there, you can start new things. So,
excellent.
Knowing who you are, I don't know, you're going to start writing your book. Do a collection of poetry, start something like that. But third house things, which is sibling stuff,
communications,
going back to school stuff, communications, in contact with those around you, and what's going on. Taking a short course, 6 weeks of cookery or something.
Yeah, short trips.
Definitely short trips, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And because... that's where the new moon's occurring. So the actual cycle, that's the synodic cycle, will start then for you in the third house. So for the whole month, you'll be able to benefit from the moon's position through your third house.
Excellent. And where's that for you?
In my seventh.
Ah.
Yeah.
The house of relationships.
This house of relationships, partnerships.
Partnerships, yeah.
So... So what are we going to say there?
Well, you can keep that to yourself if you want.
Yeah, no, I don't know. maybe we'll move things to a new phase, or pick up some new partnership work, or the partnership I have with you, we can start doing some new initiatives that we've been discussing about a little bit earlier, or changing some of the things we're going to be offering, or something like that, getting things in line.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
So that's a new moon. It depends which house in your chart it lands. Each month it will move up one house. So everybody gets an opportunity throughout the year to have a new moon in each of their houses. And the knack is to know where it's happening for you so you can make the most of it.
Absolutely.
And move on the new moon. So a new moon in Aquarius, it should be quite a new moon, you know. It's
yeah. Yeah, after all the Capricorn stuff we've been going through, it'll be nice and refreshing. And
exactly.
Yeah, zingy.
And the sun is there as well, obviously, because the sun and the moon are together. So, so we're in, the sun's in Aquarius, and the moon is going to join it there and do the new moon for that month.
Yeah. All right.
And then
we have
the first quarter will be then on the 6th of
That
would be February, 6th of February. And that's the same day that Mercury's going to go retrograde.
Right.
So. That first quarter means by the time the moon gets to the first quarter phase, it's moved out of the darkness, and from then on, from the 6th of February onwards, it's moving into the light, and things that were started at the new moon may come to fruition at the new moon as it's coming up further. That's kind of the idea with these moon placements.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not always sure whether following the moon works for everybody, because if you've got the moon strong in your chart, it definitely affects you.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Interesting. I was always wondering about that because I don't pay that much attention to it. And my moon is one of the least aspected planets in my chart. So that actually makes sense. Whereas I actually know two people that I can think of right off the top of my head who are very affected by it, who actually seem to know before it's actually happened where the moon is, just based on the kind of day they're having. And I'll frequently, you know, they'll tell me about their day, and I'll, you know, try to think, wow, gosh, that's sort of sounds extreme, you know, and I'll kind of look through, you know, what's going on that day to see if there's an explanation. And sure enough, it's always the moon. Just for these two people who the moon is very, very strong in both of their charts.
That's right. So your moon will be strong in your chart if you've got the sun in Cancer.
Yeah.
Or you've got the moon in Cancer. Or if you've got Cancer on your ascendant, or you've got the moon on your ascendant, or your midheaven, or one of the other angles. Or the moon is your most aspected, most elevated, full moon. If your moon is strong in your chart, the moon will affect you more in its monthly cycle. Whereas in your case, and actually in my case too, I've got the moon tucked away down in the bottom of the chart.
Yeah.
It's not got much to say in my life. And I find I really have to look hard to make a point of using the moon, because it's not really on the front burner for me. It's more on the back burner type movement.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is, it is. You know, the moon's got so many things to say about and I think that's why it affects probably half the population more than the other half.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, if you know people with Cancer rising, and no one I can think of comes to mind.
No, I know a lot of people with moon in Cancer, though.
Well, there you are. And that's good too. They have a well-placed moon. When the moon's in Cancer, it's well-placed.
Yeah.
Do we know what sign your moon is in? Can I ask you?
Oh, it's in Virgo.
Oh, yeah. It's in Virgo. So, yeah, again, it's not good. It's not.
But it's not conjunct the sun. Well, almost.
It's not particularly well placed there, is it? It's you know, it's not prominent, is it?
Yeah.
No.
Hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you've got the new moon placement, right?
Yeah.
You're in the new moon phase,
even
though you don't have the conjunction.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's a very loose conjunction. I guess it's, I don't know. What is it? It's like 8.5 degrees.
Yeah.
It's a conjunction.
But it would still be in the new moon phase, right?
Yeah.
So perhaps that phase, you could pay more attention to that particular phase in your month, as it were.
Yep, definitely.
But personally, you know, when I started doing astrology at the moon, it did not talk to me.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you know, one of the first things to do if you're trying to get into astrology is to follow the moon phases and
yes.
you know, to really chart that and how that works throughout the month. And I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't get interested in it, which is funny.
This is it. They say, follow your mood. How's your mood? How's your mood? Well, I'm thinking, well, it's the same. It's the same. It's the same. It's the same. Nothing changed. Well, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
And it's because I don't have a strong moon. I've got the strong sun, and the moon cannot beat it down.
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting. That's exactly. I feel the same way. That's so funny.
And yes, I have a daughter who's got, she's Cancer, moon in Cancer.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, oh, my goodness. Yes. she has her moods, you know. I think my mother was similar the same.
Yeah, mine too, actually. Not Cancer, which is Moon in Scorpio, actually, but...
There you
Moon
go.
Is very, very strongly aspected in all sorts of stuff.
Engaged in the chart. If it's not engaged, you really don't.
And she just really notices the moon going into different signs. She notices, like, immediately she feels different. And, you know, she'll say she had a bad day because, you know, the moon was in such and such and, you know, something that doesn't agree with the rest of her chart. And I'm like, wow.
Really? And then?
Yeah. That's neat. That's very neat to have that strong of a connection with it. But I just don't feel that.
No. Yeah. I don't feel it. Yeah. I think, okay, well.
Yeah. I felt it much more when Pluto went into Capricorn, or when Uranus went into Aries, I definitely noticed that,
away. Or Mercury's retrograde, I feel that I know about them, but this moon shifting, I wouldn't necessarily be following it.
Yeah.
So in a way, I suppose the astrology has to talk to you through your chart anyway. Yeah, just,
which is definitely something that you don't learn right off the bat just from, reading books and stuff, but because here we are, like, years into it. But it's a nice thing to know. You'll notice something,
absolutely, because everyone has a strong feature, and that's the thing that's knocking away at you all the time. So that's what the moon's up to. We got the new moon and we got the first quarter, and moon's growing, moon's waxing this in this podcast period. So that's our moon story.
Exactly. And so our 360 topic of the day is Mercury and Uranus.
Uranus.
And we won't do that every single time we say it, but maybe most. So what is Mercury in someone's chart? What does it mean? What does it signify?
How they think.
Well, it's the it was the god of communications the messenger of the gods.
Yes.
And it describes our communication style, how we make decisions, how we learn, how we absorb information and exchange information. You can have a different Mercury sign from your sun sign, but they're frequently very close, because obviously...
Are yours the same sun, Mercury?
They are, yeah.
Yes, I am too, yes.
They can be, different by a couple of signs, but generally it's Mercury, the planet, actually stays one sign, it stays very, very close to the sun. You can picture the solar system, and obviously that would be a good reason why that would be. Because it's just a tiny little ball, Mercury, in front of the giant blade of the sun.
Yes, it's the planet closest to the sun.
Yeah, and it just kind of orbits very tightly near the sun. So you might have one planet different. If you're in Aries, for example, you might have Mercury in Taurus, which would... very much changed your presentation as an Aries. You would have a much, different communication style from someone who had both of those planets in Aries.
That is very true.
Yeah. So it's
because if your Mercury and your Sun are in the same sign, the Sun is really very strong, and Mercury is your voice, but it's coming through with the Sun influence too.
Yeah. And if it's different, it'll be very different, because each sign is very different from the one right before or after it. Mm. I have a friend who's a Gemini. She's a double Gemini, Sun and Moon, but she has Mercury in Taurus, which... Mm-hmm. Makes her the most practical Gemini I've ever met. Which is very interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
That happens. And so people that have quite strong Mercury in their chart, obviously we would expect them to be good communicators or famous for some sort of communications.
Writing.
Yeah, writing.
Speeching.
Exactly.
Speeching. That's a word.
Speeching.
New word.
Yeah. So our first example, my first example of mercurial minds, is Harriet Beecher Stowe. She was born in a Gemini, June 14th, 1811, in Connecticut. She's got 27% Mercury, according to astrotheme.com. Uh-huh. And she's got Virgo rising, Sun, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, and the midheaven all in Gemini. We're talking... Uber Mercury. Yes. She was an American author and abolitionist. She wrote the strongly influential novel Uncle Tam's Cabin in 1852. Okay. And it attacked the cruelty of slavery. It eventually reached millions of people as both a novel and a play. It made the political issues of the 1850s tangible to people in the North who obviously were, largely against slavery. It strengthened their position against it, and it enraged the South, obviously. It was their major industry, and their whole economy depended on the slave trade and slavery as an institution. Mm-hmm. And the impact was summed up nicely in a statement that apocryphally is attributed to, oh, that's a hard sentence, geez, to Abraham Lincoln, who apparently when he met Harriet Beecher Stowe after all of this, exclaimed that she was the little woman that started the Great War with her novel. Okay. So that is one of our mercurial characters. It's very, very interesting. Messenger of the gods, indeed, bringing that whole message and publicizing such a sort of pivotal issue. And the second one is actually, funnily enough, a little bit similar. maybe not quite starting a great war, but certainly, well, Edward Snowden, the whistleblower from the NSA contractor.
Really?
Yeah, he is.
He got the word out.
Oh, yeah, big time. You know, talk about speaking up for Mercury, Gemini's everywhere. he was born June 21st, 1983 in North Carolina. He's 26% Mercury, according to AstroTheme. He has the Sun, Mercury, Mars, and his ascendant all in Gemini. Mercury is in the 12th house opposite Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in his 6th house. So he was an employee for, he was a contractor for the NSA, and he leaked details of classified, in case anyone doesn't know who he is, mass surveillance programs that the NSA has been running. He leaked those to the press in June of 2013, to Glenn Greenwald, actually, of the Guardian newspaper, and has been hiding out slash seeking asylum in Russia ever since Vladimir Putin... strangely, has offered him asylum, and probably more so to anger the U.S.
Yes,
than for any other reason. He's continued to release statements, and also the Guardian has continued to release more of the information that he leaked.
And people are still listening to what he has to say.
Absolutely, yeah. At first, there was a lot of skepticism, mm-hmm. and people were like, "How could he know all this?" Blah blah blah. But time has definitely,
But he's speaking truth.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, both these two you brought up are both strongly Gemini Mercury.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, Virgo rising for Harriet Beecher Stowe. Yeah. So interesting, though, that whole,
But people actually want to hear what they have to say.
Yeah. I'm sure that her novel was not well received at first, certainly not in the South, but, now she's practically considered a saint. I went to school in the U.S., of course, and it's one of those things that you're required to read her novel in I can't remember what grade, but
really?
It's, who knows, maybe one day Edward Snowden's I don't know.
They'll do a movie.
Oh, well, they'll definitely do a movie, I'm sure, at some point. But these are our mercurial figures, are exemplars of Mercury.
Because Mercury is also the planet that rules the guy who used to stand in Rome saying, "Here, here, here," you, telling the people whatever was written on
the
his
town
scroll.
The town crier, exactly.
Yes, the scribe who wrote down what happened as well.
Yeah.
And those early books in the early libraries, very much a mercurial.
Yeah, definitely.
Librarians and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the keepers of the knowledge. Yeah.
Yes.
I have this, I don't know, maybe this is a very Virgo thing, but I have this website that I love, and it's called, there's a swear word in the name of the website, but it's all these amazing photos of libraries, of all the great libraries in the world.
Really?
High resolution, incredibly beautiful, like the library in Rome and the library in,
Alexandria.
Sure. Yes. I mean, they
How about
built
the one in your...
Oh, yes, our library here in Vancouver is pretty magnificent.
I mean, how many books have you got there on the Against the Scroll? I have to tell our listeners that we've got multiple books here.
We've got lots of floor and ceiling bookcases.
Would you say it's strong in your chart? Would you say that?
Yeah, I would say that. It's probably the strongest planet in my chart.
Probably the strongest planet.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yes.
And are you a member of the library?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've...
Oh, yes.
I have a library card. I go to the library at least once every couple of weeks. I get audiobooks from the library because it's silly to buy them
It's silly to buy books.
Well, no, to buy books is great, and I buy books constantly, even if I don't plan on reading them sometimes, which is whatever. But audiobooks are much more expensive than just the actual paper books to read. Yeah, because, you know, it's a whole bunch of CDs usually and, you know, whatever. Yeah. And for something that I plan to listen to once. And also, I love listening to audiobooks. That's great. You know, it's a great way to, that way my boyfriend and I can read the same book at the same time, which we frequently do.
Oh,
we,
I see.
Yeah. So
how old were you when you first started library guard and went to the library?
Oh, my gosh. I would have to check with my mother, but I have to think it was pretty young.
I know.
I remember, like, the first time I remember solidly actually checking out books, I was probably 10, because I was doing a book report for school. And that's when I first remember actually getting out a pile of books. But it might have been earlier than that, for all I know.
Yeah, I was probably 10. I know my father, he was a big reader, and because he never watched TV. And he took us to we lived in the city of Blackpool at the time, which is quite a large city, but it's not that big. It's not as big as Vancouver, I suppose. And he took us to the library there, which was at the time, to my memory today, huge.
Yeah.
Because it was a great big building, and on either side there was a swing park.
Mm.
There was the north one and the south one. This library was so big, and there was like floors and floors and floors of dust tomes and everything. And I still remember that library because it was, in a way, a bit creepy. Because if you got lost, you know,
totally.
But ever since then, I wouldn't say I'm an avid library goer like you are. I do have a card for the Vancouver Library, but I've never taken a book out.
Really? I reserve things so that I don't have to, you know, skulk through the, I was going to say card catalog, but the computer's there,
I go there and sit and do work there because it's quiet.
I've done that on occasion, mostly.
They've got those little nookies you can sit at, but I've never
nice
set a book out.
Nice wireless connection, Gosh, no, I reserve things. You get 50 free, reservations a year, and they, I usually go through all 50. I reserve books so that I don't have to.
This is Prominent Mercury. It's gotta be.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah. I didn't realize that's an unusual thing, probably. That most people don't go through all 50 of their reservations a year.
I thought you'd take 1 hour because I got to take it back.
I've gone to the library with 4 friends, not at once, but over the years, I've taken 4 of my friends by the hand to the library and forced them to get a card. And I've stood there with them while they filled out the application.
Because
I am a proselytizer or something for the library. Yeah, it was important to me that they, you know, I think 2 of them at the time were unemployed. And so they were, you know, looking for a job. And I said, well, you have a library card, right? And they're like, meh. And so I marched them straight on down to the library. Another of them had just moved here. And so blah, 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 looking for, you know, events and things and whatnot and studying to, you know, stuff. Just, they needed library cards, for goodness sake.
And they say, you know, if you have a library and a garden, you have everything. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I have a plant and I have the library.
Yes, yes. Well, we're halfway there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's your strong Mercury's.
Yeah.
And you clearly, you
do. Yeah, yeah. I guess I do, certainly.
If you had to say which was the strongest planet in your chart, would you say Mercury?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would. I've done that dispositor tree thing.
Yes.
And it's always come out half, like, you know, a tie between Mercury and Venus, which annoys me.
How can you have a tie?
Well, exactly. I felt like I was doing it wrong, but apparently I haven't done it wrong. Apparently that's exactly correct.
Oh, you've got 2 trees, you mean?
There you go. Yeah.
So. Yes. You've got Team Mercury and Team Venus.
Yeah.
I'll draw the dispositor tree later on.
Yeah, exactly.
And we can have a look at that.
It's probably Mercury that's stronger because it's more aspected and all these things, and it's, you know.
The tree shows up. That's an interesting topic anyway.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
So the Uranus.
Yes. So I've got a list of as well.
So which planet is Uranus then? Let's just go over that.
Yes, it is
past Saturn.
Giant one, just past Saturn. It was discovered in 1781. Aha.
By
I was
whom?
Surprised that I knew that. I don't know. By
Herschel.
Thank you. Yes, exactly.
That's the H on the top of the Uranus symbol. Is the letter.
That's it. Good one. Very good.
Talk about trivia. Yeah.
Yeah, an interesting person too. So.
Anyway.
Exactly, Herschel.
So it's an outer planet, right?
It is an outer planet.
Okay.
It's one
so
of them.
This is what we're both saying. They're both mine planets. Hey?
Yeah, it's one of the big 3. It's considered the higher octave of Mercury, which basically means it. It takes the mercurial whatnot and kind of takes it up a level.
Yes.
It sort of electrifies it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Electricity being one of the things that it rules.
Mm-hmm.
It also is said to be associated with change, with revolution, with originality, individuality, technology, innovation, discovery, and progressiveness. Enlightenment, it's coincided with the Enlightenment in Europe and all these things.
Right.
It also, that year...
Abstract thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Concepts.
Right. French Revolution, American Revolution, all these things were happening. The beginning of, you know... 1871.
Astrology.
Yes, astrology. Exactly. A lot of astrologers have very strong Uranus in their charts. We can talk about that a little
yes,
bit later.
But
found a ton of them. That was an interesting one. Also, computer programmers, physicists, theorists, mathematicians, mad scientists, brilliant
yes,
thinkers of all types.
Einstein people.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's got Uranus as the handle of his bucket. That's really
yeah, and yeah, it's quincunx of all things Mercury.
There
so
you go.
There's an interesting one. Yeah, and this is an interesting quote from Donna Cunningham. She said, when asked if Uranus gives psychic abilities, like the way that Neptune does, she said that, I believe it has to do with reasoning that occurs at such a lightning-like speed that it appears to come from an unseen and supernatural force rather than from the person's reasoning. People will say, you must be psychic, but instead it's that their observation is putting together tons of memories and things that they've read but hardly remember where they came from, all at the speed of light. So that is an interesting thing for people who have a strong Uranus in their chart.
Yes, yes. It's to do, they taught me when I was years ago that the way your brain is in two halves.
Mm, yeah.
One's in words, one's in pictures. I can't remember which one's
right. Brain is the pictures and left is the words.
Okay, so the one is run by Mercury and the other one's run by Uranus.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
So your pictures, but the words are the Mercury.
Yeah, and that's interesting too because a lot of the people that are very right-brained, it's a lot of the computer programmers that I've met are very more right-brained than left-brained. They can, and that's frequently why they're seen as sort of antisocial. It's just because they don't talk, you know, to people as much.
They're
yeah.
They don't need it.
But yeah, but it's interesting. I've worked in software companies where you know the software, you know, the engineer, you know, the engineers, the department that deals with the actual coding of the software, they work,
don't talk to the rest of them.
Right, but they work like this little tightly knit little machine. And that's very right brain because it's very holistic. It's very sort of, you know, abstract. And people that are, you know, the marketing people or the, you know, the communications people kind of walk by and go, they're weird, you know, I don't know what's going on. But they're like a little, you know, little humming machine, you know, all
yes,
very cohesive and
yes,
very, you know, sharing all their information. And
they talk a different language, don't they?
They do, yeah.
They talk COBOL or however
yeah,
old you are, Fortran, if you're as old as I am.
Good one. Totally. Yeah, so we've got, and very interestingly that we've gone down the road of talking about the coders and whatnot, because my first ultra-Uranian Uber-Uranian is Alan Turing. Famous mathematician, logician, computation genius. He was born in June of 1912 in London. He's 26% Uranus, according to AstroTheme.
Wow.
And he had Uranus and Aquarius conjunct the MC. He, during World War II, was recruited to serve in the government code and cipher school, and he was largely responsible for Britain's success at deciphering the Nazi Enigma codes,
okay,
which enabled them to intercept codes sent to their ships in the North Atlantic, which were, you know, bombing the crap out of all the Allies' ships.
Yes.
So that it was huge and wonderful.
That's interesting.
Yeah. He was just a sort of a genius with mathematics.
Genius, that's the key word.
Genius, exactly.
And Enigma, actually.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And, you know, helped them win the war and all these things. Unfortunately, he also was homosexual, which at the time was frowned upon, and, you know, to say the least. He was actually convicted in 1952, I believe, or 51, of having a gay relationship with a young man. And he was given a year's probation on the condition that he take estrogen injections, which is not a very pleasant thing. And in fact, 2 years later, caused him to commit suicide. But in 2009, Prime Minister Gordon Blair announced posthumously that he was pardoned.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Gordon Blair. You know, pardoned him and said that he was sorry. You know, from
Tony Blair.
No, Gordon Blair. Gordon Blair.
Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown. Thank you. My goodness, I am very mistaken there. How did I have that wrong? Yeah, Gordon Brown.
No problem.
They rhyme, you know. Blair
I
Brown.
Know. I know.
Yeah.
They were good buddies anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Posthumous pardon, apology on the behalf of the crown and whatnot.
Gosh, how interesting.
So 50 years later. So, you know. Yeah. Thanks for helping win the war, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But beautiful story, tragic, you know, all these things. Interesting, too, the suicide, he ate an apple laced with cyanide as his method of suicide.
Wow.
Which may or may not have been so that his mother, you know, would not think that he committed suicide. But also, it's you know, the graphic symbology, I can't help but think is pretty evocative and interesting. And also, now we have Apple as the biggest computer company in the world, with the symbol being an apple with a bite out of it, which may or may not be a coincidence. I don't know. We can't ask Steve Jobs anymore, but... It's out there as a rumor that it's possible that that was why the logo. But it's not confirmed. That
because of
no
Alan
one at
Turing.
Apple has ever... Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the father of computing. Yeah.
Huh.
Yep. But Apple hasn't confirmed that. That's just one of those things that people say. No, it's, you know...
I expect to hear from
it's
them
out there.
Speak.
Yeah, really. But, you know, if not, it's one of those great coincidences that's just a cool thing, you know?
Okay.
One of those beautiful coincidences.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because Apple used to be striped anyway, didn't it?
Striped? Yeah. Yeah. Because of the dot matrix printers. That's how I picture it.
Okay.
Yeah. And we have one more ultra-Uranian. F. Scott Fitzgerald, the famous novelist of short stories, novels. He's regarded as one of the greatest 20th century writers. He died of, well, he had a very sort of tempestuous life, relationship, alcoholic sort of thing happening, you know, died fairly young. He lived from 1896 to 1940. Mm-hmm. So famously wrote The Great Gatsby and was one of the self-styled lost generation of Americans born in the 1890s who came of age during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, he's got a very sort of Uranian...
chart.
Uranian, yeah, very, let's see, 25% Uranus.
So you see, now that's interesting, because it's a quarter of the chart, and I think that was about the same number you gave for all of those. So for one planet to be dominant in a quarter of the chart, when you think there's 10 planets all together...
It's quite, even though it's...
It's really quite big.
Yeah, it's lower than some of the percentages we've quoted. I mean, I think that, you know, we've had up to 62% for some of our characters that we've described in past podcasts, but 25% still, as you say, 10 planets, that's not nothing to sneeze at.
Indeed.
And you know, Mercury and Uranus also. What am I trying to say? Yeah.
Good Lord. They work together, or they can work apart.
Yeah, exactly. And with these people, it's more just that planet is super strong, as opposed to, you know, there being a strong aspect between them.
Okay.
But that is also a thing.
It is. Do you want to go on about that a bit?
Well, we certainly can. Yeah, I've got a bit of a list.
Okay, you do. Okay.
Well, you know.
we love a list.
We love a list. We do. Okay, so Mercury-Uranus aspects. We've got conjunctions. Basically, I went through the conjunctions, oppositions, squares, and trines.
Okay.
Yeah. Mercury conjunct Uranus. We've got Chelsea Manning, Sigmund Freud, and I had somebody else.
And me.
Yes, and you. That is right. That is correct. Exactly. So do you want to tell us a bit about what that is like?
Oh, well, it's all right for me. It's sometimes difficult for others.
For Sigmund Freud, maybe. No. Well, we know that Chelsea Manning is not having a delightful time at the moment, being in prison for releasing information, which is very, you know, Mercury-Uranus thing, disruptive information, rebellious, you know, possibly seditious or whatever, but, you know, definitely releasing information that wanted to be free.
Now, you say Freud there as well.
Freud, yeah.
Now, he was one who could unlock information from other people's brains.
Exactly, right? And disruptive information, too. People... maybe didn't want to know it, or, you know, still are trying to sort of deny it.
Yeah, still trying to work it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Work through it, right?
Yeah.
But what do we say then if they're conjunct, that the left and right brain work together and therefore the person's more focused? I don't know. What would you say of that?
Well, in the three examples that we have here, I would say that might be.
Okay.
Sure.
Because then, of course, they're both in the same sign.
Yes.
So the sign then becomes a focus as well. So you're talking and what you're... Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe you can deliver sort of... you know, surprising or unsettling or you know, revolutionary information, you know, that much easier than...
You know, my husband always says he never knows what I'm going to say.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, exactly. I bet people said that to Freud.
And I'm thinking, after all these years, and there is a lot of them.
What a delightful thing.
And he's, well, I
would like that. I mean, that's a great thing.
And I'm saying, come on, you know, me, I know what I'm going to... I mean, as far as I'm concerned, my life just goes on like this. But from the owl, from the onlooker, yeah. I apparently I'm doing this and I don't see it.
Huh.
Do you feel that you never know what...
Well, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, actually, yeah. That's funny. Because you said something earlier before we started taping, and you had this look on your face like you had something to say, and I had no idea what you were going to say. It was exciting.
Oh, no.
It's true.
But I had like, to tell you.
Yeah.
And it came out in a whole chunk. That's the thing. When you've got Mercury conjunct Uranus, there's no smooth way of telling people that those pants make you look fat. It just comes. And that's why I say when I text people, I can see it afterwards and think, that sounded like I just went blurt. I blurt.
Yeah.
I really try not to.
That's funny. I think texting, though, is probably very, you know, it's just built for that.
For blurting. Whereas now when I'm writing an email, I never actually send an email the same day. I now like to think about it overnight so I can go and read it and get the tone right, because the tone comes across as blurt.
Yeah, if you send it just like a text, yeah.
Yes.
That's funny. But they come in the same way for me. I mean, because I get your texts as email.
Do you?
I do, because I don't have a cell phone.
Of course. So
they all look like emails to me.
I'm giving away a secret
there.
That's
so funny.
But that's when you get that you haven't got the time to get the punctuation right, or you're saying, dear Arwen, and I'm thinking, oh, I should have said that. And then I think, well, should have said, dear
comma,
Arwen.
Line break.
Dear Arwen and Mr. Pink, and oh, is he going to, you know. And there's just no time. I'm just going,
right.
Information has to be sent.
Yes, so, exactly. That could actually be the keyword right there for Mercury Uranus information.
Okay, so we'll leave it at that, I think. Before I say too much.
All right. Well, we do have a few more aspects. Mercury opposite Uranus.
Okay.
We have Oscar Wilde, Truman Capote, and Friedrich Nietzsche.
Okay.
So that's an interesting combination right there.
So what, they thinking differently to their...
Yeah, I mean, it's still information has to be relayed, but it's definitely more... calculated. There are big, massive, you know, things
debates?
To be told.
Maybe going
there's
on
debate. There's conflict. Certainly,
with, weighing the.
Yeah, and there's, maybe there's a disagreement after the fact about the either value or meaning or, you know, intention of their words.
Or even did they understand it when they got the message?
Mm.
With an opposition, I would think.
Yeah.
You know, you hear people who say, I thought I told you this, and the person didn't quite get what you said.
Yeah.
But in your mind, it made sense.
Yeah.
So maybe that's somehow brought in.
Oh, sure. With all three of those, I could see that being an issue.
Yes.
And, you know, and there's also, you know, the interesting thing of, like, there being two different ways to take their communications. Oscar Wilde, you can either, you know, you can read deeply into, you know, all of the whatnot, or you can just kind of skim across the top of the aphorisms and, you know, all the lovely little quotes that he left behind, which is just, there's a quote about everything that he said. I you know, I've got tons of them on my own website. I, you know, who doesn't love to quote Oscar Wilde? Who doesn't quote him without even knowing it?
God knows, I don't
know. Wonderful person to quote. Truman Capote, like, wrote In Cold Blood, a non-fiction novel, which I believe is the first of those. It's since become a thing, but at the time it was you know, it was a true story of this horrible crime that had happened in the Midwest, and he, you know, researched it in great detail. He spent time with the convicts, and maybe too much time according to some, and blah blah blah, and so there was this, on one hand, this incredible, you know, investigative journalism side of it, but on the other hand, there's this lurid, you know, maybe getting too close to the subject, and kind of maybe there's something unseemly about it, and maybe it could just be just, you know, taken as like this sort of icky, you know, kind of descent into all these grotesque details of these unpleasant people and this horrible
crime. Too much information.
Maybe too much information, maybe just unpleasant information that people didn't, you know, think should be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, did that ever, you know, I mean, there's an entire industry now of true crime, you know, novels and true crime magazines and true crime everything. And, you know, America's most whatever, you know, grisly mass murders on every channel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is a thing that people want to know about for good or ill, you know. And he was right on that, you know, he's almost invented the form, really.
Right, yeah. Right.
So that's the opposition.
Okay.
Mercury square Uranus. We have Baudelaire, the French poet. We have Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. We have Elizabeth I. We have Dick Cheney and Adolf Eichmann.
Whoa.
Yeah. So what do we have to say about those? That combination of people.
Well, I know they said that when Winston Churchill wrote, he used the simplest words so every man could understand what he wanted to say.
Interesting.
He would never use a long word when he could use a short one.
Oh, yeah. And even, I mean, Baudelaire, I was a huge fan of his poetry when I was 13, so it must be readable, you know,
yes,
for a 13-year-old to grasp it and to find it, you know, so romantic and beautiful and, you know, very Scorpio rising and all those things, of course, you know, the flowers of evil. Mm. But, you know, it must have been simple enough that a 13-year-old could, you know,
right.
I wasn't at a, you know.
And yet the message is so powerful.
Oh, so powerful. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Love and death and God and, you know, mm-hmm. all these things. And he dying of syphilis at a very young age and all these mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah. And Elizabeth I, interesting. Also a very, I mean, she was, we don't have, you know, obviously a lot of her writing, but mm-hmm. we know that she actually was a very intellectual leader.
Yes.
And, you know,
at a time when men were running the show.
Oh, yeah. But the daughter of Henry
VIII. When is that not the case?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not when she was in power for quite some time and, you know, expanding the empire and sending
yes.
ships out to
yes.
everywhere. And, yeah.
Spreading the word.
Well, you know, we don't need to get into the whole Catholic Protestant thing, but it's interesting because there's always sort of a dichotomy, you know. There's always the... yeah, the two sides of, you know, the communication of you know, to the people.
Yes.
Because you have to, as a ruler, I mean, you know, obviously she would have known better than most leaders the importance of having the people on your side and, you know, that. But at the same time, you know, ruling with a strong hand and, you know, not letting anyone sort of think they can, you know,
talk
push you over.
Or, yes.
Yeah. And she definitely had, like, a lot of enemies and even within her own... I want to
yes.
say cabinet, but that's probably not the right word. Her advisors, I
yes.
guess, you know, but prevailed. Interesting. Our last two examples, Dick Cheney. I don't want to say Dick Cheney and Adolf Eichmann, so there's some sort of a... but it's interesting, though, that they were both advisors to, you know, powerful men in charge of whatnot, but in a way are seen as more powerful than the men in charge in,
mm-hmm.
in a sort of a lasting sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're... People often joke that Dick Cheney was the actual president during Bush
yes.
the second, so
yes.
George W. Bush.
The power behind the throne, even.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, you have only to, you know, see either of them speak for 5 minutes to kind of maybe
yes.
believe that that might be true.
And Winston Churchill, persuasive speaker.
Incredibly.
Orator.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And he wrote, I don't know how many books, but a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Prolific writer and speaker and... His words are obviously also very quotable and very, you know.
Yes.
Yes. His speeches to the Parliament during the beginning of World War II were beautiful
mm.
and
mm.
very affecting. And, you know, you watch them.
We were living surrounded.
Mm. All of that, yeah. Tiny Island and then, you know. Oh, gives you chills just thinking, literally. I'm not even British. But, yeah. So there's that. And our last category is Mercury trine Uranus.
Right.
Trine is much more sort of flowing and, you know,
mm-hmm.
easy sort of aspect. So the people in this category are Niccolo Machiavelli,
uh-huh.
Abraham Lincoln, Robert McNamara, and William Blake. So we can see a lot of the same sort of characteristics as the square, for example, but a lot more sort of, I mean...
Softer messages, do you think?
Well, certainly not in the case of Machiavelli, but in a weird way, it's almost like the way that they get their incredibly, you know, powerful point across was more sort of flowing, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
More
more acceptable.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Presented better.
Yeah, I mean, I've read the Prince, Machiavelli's, you know, book about the boiled down to it's better to be feared than loved, how to lead with a strong, you know, iron fist and whatnot.
In the velvet glove.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's very persuasive. It's compelling.
Persuasive.
You read it and
compelling.
You're just like, well, yeah, that's the way to do that. You know, that's the way to have a kingdom of subjects.
So when they've got the trine, they can use both very well.
Yeah, that's what I would say, yeah.
Not chunking.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And not, you know, in support of whatever, you know, whatever they're supporting, you know, you'll kind of go, okay, yeah. Or, right. Yeah. And even if there is some struggle, I mean, obviously Abraham Lincoln, you know, his, you know, yeah. His speeches are still being quoted today, and you know, every bit is, you know, it's probably not very many presidents of you know the last 100 years that we know their words better than Abraham Lincoln.
Well, who could you even think of in the recent in living memory? Who's
oh, in my living memory? None. No. No. Not at all. yeah. I mean,
just old Clinton's comment.
I was thinking of that one actually. That's the first thing that came to mind, which is sad. Which is.
But apart from that, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah, and any of their speeches. I mean, any like there were a few good speeches that Reagan gave, and they were all because they were written by this woman speechwriter who was brilliant, and you know, now has written speeches for everyone else. But you know, the Challenger speech, for example, comes to mind. Beautiful words, you know, it's stirring and wonderful.
So what are we saying? That if you've got Mercury trining Uranus, you actually can get your message across palatably, is it even? Or,
yeah.
And you should, because if it's in your chart, you should work that aspect.
Yeah.
Do you have an aspect between your two?
I don't. No,
oh,
my Uranus is unaspected. I believe it's pretty much unaspected. No, it's fully unaspected. Yeah,
fully
it's just
unaspected Uranus.
Floating there in my 12th house all by itself.
There you go.
Yeah. It's actually opposite Chiron, but it's Chiron is. We don't always use it. And it's a loose up. It's not like me. Chiron, you know, I mean, sorry. Mercury is very strong in my chart, but not the other.
Not Uranus. So
not
that's Uranus. It. Because when you've got an aspect, one of the planets is always going to be stronger than the other on the whichever is strong on the other one end or the other.
Yeah.
In your case, you're saying, well, even without the aspect, you're saying Mercury's stronger than Uranus.
Yeah.
Totally, because
no
you're
question.
Even telling us now that Uranus is at the 12th house and unaspected.
Yeah.
It hasn't got a chance.
Although a lot of, I mean, there is a school of thought that thinks that unaspected planets have their own, you know, interesting
Absolutely.
Life of their own kind of thing.
They do, but your Mercury
is...
You're going to have to go a long way to beat that down.
Exactly.
If that's the case.
Yeah.
So even though you don't have an aspect, you've got quite a combination between your Mercury and the Uranus there, you see. They're not level pegging at all.
No. And especially in the 12th house, sort of hiding there.
Yes, yes.
Yours, where's your conjunction?
In the first house.
Yes.
Yes, you see, so.
So that's...
So I'm the sort of person who writes a blog post it, and then I'll read it the next morning and think, oh, look, there's a spelling mistake.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Then I go back in and edit it because I think I've got this message.
Yeah.
You know, like with Mandela, I had to put that chart out, that I had to go, and then I went back after and thought, oh, dear, it's Dan's old butts, and checking that Schumacher last week. Oh, let me fix these back. But I had to get the message out first.
Oh, that's funny. I will go through 7 kinds of hell to avoid that ever happening to me.
Well, I...
Just because I am so paranoid about that. It's so funny. It's because of Mercury. Yeah, and Mercury is very active in dancing around, but it's just like, you know, don't misspell it.
Because I don't have the one, I don't think... I wouldn't know which one would be stronger than the other. I didn't think about that.
That's funny. That's so interesting. So, yeah, we will put all these charts up there. William Blake, Robert McNamara. Interesting. Here's an interesting thing about Robert McNamara. He's Gemini also.
Right.
And he's got Mercury, trine, Uranus. And he was obviously the
Secretary
of Defense. Thank you. He had been... at Ford, and he was recruited by Kennedy, and then he worked through the eventual, Johnson administration, and then, So through the 60s, he was basically the architect of the Vietnam War, and he ended up later on, I wouldn't say regretting, but if you've seen The Fog of War, it's a brilliant documentary by Errol Morris. It's a very long, extended interview with Robert McNamara. He just basically talks to the camera about his life and about his history and about the wars and about, you know, whatever. But there is this amazing scene where he's talking about the bombing campaigns during World War II, and he worked for General Chris LeMay, and they were calculating these bombing campaigns that they were doing over Japan. And in this interview, Robert McNamara is about 80-something. He's just got this fiery sort of, you know, Gemini intelligence still blazing from his eyes. He's very animated, and he's talking about the numbers and about how many people were killed in each of these bombing runs. And he's just reeling off these numbers. He's like saying, you know, Tokyo was about the population of New York. So imagine, you know, 60-something% of New York City, you know, killed in one night. And he's reeling off these cities, like Cincinnati is about the, you know, size of Yokohama and all these
statistics.
Things. Yeah, and he can remember these things from, I mean, this is from the 40s. And he did this interview in 2000 and something, and it's just, you're going, holy crap, like, this guy is amazing.
Yeah.
But it's a horrible, you know, thing he's talking about, but at the same time, you're just riveted because the intelligence of the man, the calculating ability, someone called him a, you know, a computer with legs, an IBM with legs back in the 60s, and still, in his 80s, this was, you know, so readily apparently true. It was just, you know, it's unsettling, but you can't look away. It's an amazing documentary because you kind of feel yourself going, wow, the charisma of the man, but yet, you know, the evil, you know. And he did regret these things, sort of. It's hard to even put it in those terms, but just a very compelling, very fascinating person. And if you want to see Mercury and Uranus, you know, working their magic through an individual, watch The Fog of War. That would be...
That's great.
It's right there on his face, yeah.
So are you going to put up these charts or just the photos or combination?
Yeah, these will be in our show notes.
On our website.
On our website, accessastrology.com.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So Mercury, Uranus, the
mind
thinking,
planets.
The mind planet.
Yeah.
The thinking man's planet.
Yeah.
If you're lucky. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One will be more dominant than the other in your chart.
Yeah. Or they'll be like with you, where you can't tell which is stronger.
I'd have to think a bit longer about that. Yes, yes. I'd have to think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know one better than I do, the way it's coming across, you see. I don't know. Bits of paper everywhere, notes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, bits of paper.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is our Astrology 360 topic of the day. We also have a couple of book reviews.
We do.
So
we do.
Let's talk about this book that you've got.
Yeah. So the book I'm reviewing this time is A Synastry, Understanding the Astrology of Relationships by Rod Susskind.
Hmm.
Do you know him?
I don't, no.
He's a South African astrologer.
Hmm.
And when I was a young warthog, which is the same we use now, I was still at school and he was writing the horoscopes in the women's magazine. They're called Fair Lady, and he's still going strong.
Very cool.
He was just out, so I came down. And I know he's running, doing his MA at the moment. But anyway, I believe this is the only book he's written, but I don't know. And I probably picked it up last year or the year after, and it's really quite good. He's got quite... Synastry, by the way, is a way of... working on male-female relationships, and is he the one? Do we get on? Where do we get on? Why don't we get on?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is.
Relationship astrology. Yes. Not necessarily romantic. You know, you can actually...
True.
But usually it is. But you can actually run a synastry chart for any pair that you want to know how they interact.
Any pair.
Yeah.
So anyway, and he's got some actual good ideas. I can't go into them all now. But he's got some like good ideas, some tables of how to break it down, first steps in chart comparison.
Good. Yeah. So when you first approach the couple, you know, comparison.
So you've got sort of like a his and hers chart, and you want to see how's this relationship going. And he talks about the basics in the first chapter, and then relationship regarding the individuals. But he's talking to astrologers with this. This is how to do synastry.
Mm.
And then he's got a lot of interpretations for the composites and so on element combinations and foundations, basic chart comparison, life issues.
Cool.
Tables and a gazillion charts at the back, and it's really quite a good book. And how to do a consultation for synastry, and who can you, answering the question about can you, if the woman comes to you, you know, about what her husband's chart, ethically, can you do her husband's chart when he's not there or knows about it?
And what is the answer?
Well, we have to toe the line and say it's unethical to do that without permission to do somebody's chart. Yeah, I have to say that.
Nice.
Of course, you know.
Yeah.
One does. But.
But you can.
Ethically, astrologically, we have to say you need permission to work on people's charts. You can't just do them.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think that's interesting.
Okay.
I honestly hadn't heard that.
Had you not?
No, and I'm not a consulting astrologer, so.
Yes,
so it's
if
okay
she comes
that I
and
haven't
says,
heard
is
that.
He the one, and then they keep coming, is he the one, and that's your ethical question.
Yeah.
That's like. part of the first stuff, ethics, where do you draw the line? Yeah. Where do you draw the line on charts you're going to do for other people? If a mother comes and says, can you do my daughter's chart? Do you do it? Well, yes, you do, because she's the guardian of that child. Mm. But if the grandmother comes and says, can you do my granddaughter's chart? The answer's no.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's...
And what if the child's an adult? Same?
Well, if the child's an adult, they need permission. They have to give you permission.
Interesting.
You can't, but if the grandmother, say there's a newborn baby,
saying, yeah,
and
totally.
You can't just do it for the grandmother.
Right.
Another goal.
Interesting.
I know. I had the situation where I'm going off topic now, that today with a chap I was talking to this afternoon, and he said that he'd like to get his daughter, who's 15, have me to have a look at her chart. And I said, absolutely, if you're giving permission, I could do that when I'm 18.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the parents' permission, but I will still do her chart privately between me and her if she's passed the Jupiter return at 12. Anyway, so Russ Hoskins got a lot to say, and I do recommend this book, and I'll put up a picture of it on the website.
Cool.
And you can order it through, I don't know, Amazon or wherever. Mm-hmm. Actually, I picked up this copy, I think, down at Banyan Books.
Oh, excellent. Great bookstore in Vancouver.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, it's the only show in town, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I don't know. If anybody knows of another one, let me know.
Yeah, no kidding. There used to be one out in New Westminster, a tiny little one, though. I'm not sure if it's even there anymore.
Anyway.
Sorry if it is and they're listening.
If it is, do write them.
Do write us and tell us.
But, Banyan, you've been to Banyan Books.
I have. Very rarely, though, because it's a couple of buses out from where...
It's a mission.
It's a mission. It is.
You have to get to number 43 in Burrard and
it takes
stand
forever to
all
get
the
there
way.
Yeah, long drive. But there are a lot of nice little used bookstores on the way, which I always end up going to first because I see them and I'm like, oh, and I never get out there. So I jump off the bus and I end up getting, you know, distracted and going to like six different used bookstores and having a pile of books by the time I get there. And then I'm like,
Well, right. The last time I went to the bookshop, I took this bag to carry the books back in, and I took limited cash. I didn't take my credit card because I knew there was so much stuff I wanted. I just couldn't carry it out of there.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, I can't come here anymore.
Exactly.
I'm not... safe.
No,
anyway.
The last time I went there, I think I ended up buying 3 books, but I came home with about 8 because I had gone to these other used bookstores.
I mean, I bought a November's last time I was there. What was that?
Well, apparently it's, you know, better than ordering stuff from a certain bookstore, which is just up the street, which takes a month and a half.
Don't deliver.
Good Lord.
And when you do get it, we'll review it.
Yeah. You know, February by then.
Yeah, so that's Sinistry by Rod Suskin, recommended for Sinistry and forecasting work.
Wonderful.
Relationship work. Yeah. And you have a book for us today.
I do, and it's an oldie but a classic. Dynasty, The Astrology of Family Dynamics by Erin Sullivan. She is obviously an epic, you know, astrologer, writer.
Well known.
On the conference circuit and whatnot. This was first published in 1996, so it's not that old.
No.
At all.
We've read older books.
We've much, much older, yeah. But this is one of the books, one of the few actually, out of my entire massive, you know, astrology collection, where I have highlighted, I have scribbled in the margins, just a random page here, there are exclamation points, there are underlines, there are little stars in the margins.
So is it talking about generational astrology?
Generational astrology, yeah. And also the relationships between different types of families and different aspects that are aspects and planetary sort of dominances that tend to run in families, and certain families can be characterized, you know, by certain planets that are very dominant in that family. And it's just fascinating. She gives obviously a couple of examples that one might even be able to throw out a guess if they were to say, well, what kind of families would she talk about? Well, of course the Kennedys are in there, for example. But she talks about the, you know, the Uranian type family and the Neptunian type family and how these are very different and very
really?
Sort of obvious types of really interesting.
And how would you know which type of family you are then?
Well, if you have all the charts of you know, a few generations worth, you can sort of see, you know, maybe a group of people in the family, maybe even all of the people that you have the charts for, will have that planet very strong in their charts individually.
Okay.
And then when you look at the Sinistry aspects between individuals, two individuals in, you know, in the family, that there'll be very strong planetary connections
so
to those.
So we would say, look at you, look at your mother, look at your grandmother.
Right.
Say, oh, you've all got moon in Virgo or something.
Two out of three of us, just as an example, do have.
Is that so?
Yeah, and then Virgo is a huge planet in you know, my, like, the mother side of my family. If you go back like 5 generations, there's a massive amount of Virgo and Leo, actually. Yeah, very, very strong. And there are just very, you know, very common repetitive aspects that you can see in the charts of all five of us, like very close.
The aspects repeating, or the aspect between two planets.
Yeah, there's actually one aspect, I can't remember which it is right off the top of my head right now, but that all five of us have, which is...
Weird, like a family aspect.
Literally. I can't even think about what the odds of that are, but not very, you know, the odds are just...
Let me ask you then, does this only run through bloodlines, or would it be if you'd say you had an adopted brother, would he be part of this automatically?
That is a fascinating question, and I can actually probably research that and get back to you, because my boyfriend happens to have been adopted and has both, you know, we have the information... Of both families, so I can figure that out.
It never ends.
Strangely, I haven't actually done that, but I do have all their charts. Yeah.
Oh, you do. You do. Yeah, I have charts of my family. I have my parents. My grandparents only know no times, but I've got their dates.
Yeah.
And I can go back quite a bit because I've done quite a bit of extensive family tree work naturally, living in the fourth house. So I'm the sort of keeper of the family tree in my family.
Yeah.
But I don't have times for the guys going further back. But I hadn't considered even looking to, because none of my parents have got anything that relates to me, so, or maybe they do and I haven't looked properly. So you're looking for a dominant planet and a dominant aspect?
Yeah, like, for example, I think it's Venus, let's see. One thing is Moon Pluto. There's three out of five of us that have Moon Pluto aspects in the, you know, the five generations of the women in my family. Then there's five of us have Mercury, Saturn. Five of us have Venus, Midheaven aspects.
We're different aspects.
Yeah, and Mars, Mars, Saturn, oddly. Yeah. That's just an interesting thing. And so you can look at these things, or you can... the Uranian versus Neptunian family. Let's see. I think it's the Uranian family that she talks about with the Kennedys. And it's...
So what are we saying? That Uranus is a theme for the whole family?
Yeah, totally. Exactly. And that it's a very, you know, originality, you know, eccentricity, sort of, you know, these interesting characters, these individual characters. And it's less about the relationships between family members as it is about these very strong personalities. And the Neptunian type of family, which is much more about the connection and the sort of symbiotic relationship, and maybe, you know, maybe too close, you know, kind of for some that want their individuality, but they can't ever seem to break away from the family, and everything is very interconnected and very, you know, and that would be a different type of family, which is these two.
So were you able to categorize your own family?
It's weird there are a lot of artists and things in my family, but at the same time, very, very close relationships. There's not a lot of, maybe two siblings at most for like the last five, back to my grandmother's mother, who was, you know, the youngest of a large family. But my grandmother has one sibling, my mother has one sibling, half sibling even, and I've got two half brothers who I didn't grow up with. You know, they were born when I was 12 and 13. So, you know, very, very small sort of family, you know.
Yeah.
Nuclear family is very, you know, tiny. So very close-knit through the generations, which is more Neptunian. But at the same time, then there's the sort of, you know, Uranian. We move around a lot. There's a lot of artistic sort of, you know, not like just tied down to one kind of job sort of, you know, thing. So very kind of both. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, because my father, my grandfather, and my great grandfather were all policemen.
Wow.
So was my mother.
Really?
Yes. Now that you mention it. But I hadn't drawn the dots before. That's just how it was in those days, wasn't it?
I don't know. Was it? That's amazing.
If your father was a carpenter, you became a carpenter.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that part of it. Yeah. Golly.
But whether or not they all have the same, I can't look, thinking myself now to my parents' charts, I don't see any immediate
any common thread that goes police, because you know, with fire, you know, firemen, that's a very common thing in families, and a lot of those, you can, they're fire signs, like, just, you know,
amazing,
obvious,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, it's one of the most obvious sort of, you know, funny, things that leaps out astrologically. Yeah. It's
I know my sister and I have got the same moon sign, but that's about as far as that goes, but my brother doesn't, so I don't know.
It's interesting. But she, yeah, she also talks about the moon a lot, about how, you know, different people in the family, like, of, you know, one mother can have three children who all have different moon signs. And
yes.
But the moon represents the mother, and in some way she will represent to each of the individual children what their moon sign is.
Their experience of her is different. Yeah.
The youngest child may have been, you know, a few years later, and will have, you know, maybe like the moon in Cancer, for example, and she'll be like the ideal mother to him or her. And the other children will have, you know, experienced her as a completely different woman. Maybe the first one has, you know, moon in Capricorn or something, because maybe she was sort of conflicted about whether to quit working or to be, you know, full-time mother. And there's that whole thing. And, you know, and so he'll experience her completely
differently. Because my two older kids have both got moon in Leo, right? Mm. Which I know.
Wow.
And then my third one has a moon in Sag. But the last one's got moon in Capricorn. And I think clearly she sees me as the older mother. I'm older than all her peer group's mother, because I just am, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Wow. And you were probably, you know, back to working full-time and whatnot by the time she was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even now, you know, it's...
Yeah. That's neat.
So it's kind of, yeah. And I see it, my sister and I, because we both have the Scorpio moon, but my brother's got the Virgo moon, so he saw her entirely differently.
Right. Fascinating. That's very cool.
Sorry, no, I'm getting off the subject.
No, it's totally not off the subject, because that's exactly what this whole book is about, is, you know, family
so
dynamics.
So can you see your moon going back through your generations?
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've got moon in Virgo, and so does my grandmother, and my grandmother's mother was a Virgo, and an uber Virgo. She was a school teacher. She dressed in, like, these... just perfectly tailored prim little suits, and I've got a lot of her jewelry, actually. These wonderful, like,
oh, nice.
Amazing, you know, from the 30s and 40s, just elegant, perfect, like, pearls surrounded by, you know, sort of neat little stones, and just these, you know, very Virgo, very classy, very, you know, color-coordinated. I have this amazing photo of her in this beautiful sort of Tiffany teal aqua colored blazer, which I have one of from a vintage store that's almost the exact identical color. She's got these perfect little earrings that match it exactly, and I don't. But I didn't even buy the jacket thinking of that, of course, and then I saw the picture and I just went, oh my God. So yeah, there's a definite Virgo thread that just, you know, it's like a vein of whatever element.
Like a vein of Virgo coming through.
Yeah, a vein of Mercury all the way through the
generations. A vein of Mercury flowing. Here we go, flowing.
Indeed. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Good one, though.
Very. So, yeah, I totally recommend that. If you are, you know, at all into sort of any kind of family history or you know, doing the... what's the word? The genealogy stuff, which I
get
into.
Yes.
All that stuff. This
I
is
know,
just great
I've read books about where, like, the British royal family, how they're very Taurian coming through.
Yeah.
And so you've got the Taurus Scorpio axis thing triggering there.
Yeah,
but it's
Charles
shifted
Scorpio.
Now with William and Kate, because they've got those, they've both got those eclipses.
Yeah.
But it's just, yeah, it's interesting. There's so many sides to astrology, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And of course, Queen Elizabeth I being like the ultimate Virgo monarch. The,
was she Virgo?
Virgin Queen, Jesus, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
She's one of my favorite examples, along with Napoleon, of course, the Leo. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So, that book was called...
Dynasty, The Astrology of Family Dynamics by Aaron Sullivan.
Very good.
Yes.
Very good.
Great. Highly recommended. I've used quotes from that book in many an article. Attributed, always, of course, linking back to her site and whatnot. But very useful information. Very, very well written, too.
Good.
Indeed. Our next podcast is going to be on the topic of Pisces.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
We've come to the very last sign.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that.
We'll be discussing that next time.
Yeah, 2 weeks from now.
So if anybody wants to email us, it's accessastrology@gmail.com. And we're on Twitter at
accessastrology for our website, show notes, links to all of the things that we talk about.
Yes,
lots of stuff like that. Access Astrology is produced and recorded by Roger Aaron Toes. I'm Arwen O'Neill, and
I'm Alison Price, and see you next time.